we've got a lot of ground to cover, but just a show of hands, how many people watch Justified, and then how many have seen or watched Breaking Bad? Okay, and of those, how many are current with Breaking Bad? Okay, all right, so later on I'm going to show, and just a disclaimer, this is pretty Breaking Bad heavy, so I'm going to first start talking about Justified, and then but then most of the talk is going to be about Breaking Bad. I just think it's more interesting. But the opening clip I'm going to show you is from the pilot for Justified. It's the closing scene. And Justified is based on a character, Raylan Givens, who's like a U.S. deputy marshal who comes back home to Kentucky where he was born and raised. And he sort of has to face his demons while at the same time being the deputy marshal, sort of lawman. It's on FX. And in the opening scene, you're given this picture of "don't cross me" kind of lawman sheriff of the classic like Western trope. He's kind of a Wyatt Earp type figure. So if he's standing for the law, he's doing so objectively. He's in Miami. It's the first scene and the last scene that he's ever in Miami. But he's in Miami and he's talking to this gun thug, he's basically telling the gun thug, you have 2 minutes. We've discussed this. You have 2 minutes to get out of town, or I'm going to shoot you. And so for 2 minutes they kind of banter back and forth, and the guy doesn't leave and just thoughtlessly Raylan pulls out and shoots this guy in kind of not cold-blooded form. He pulled first, the criminal, and so that's what the show is making use of. It was justified. It was justified because he pulled first. That's kind of the last straw, and so he has to move back to Kentucky where his family history is. And the last scene that you see of the pilot episode, he has broken into his ex-wife's house, and he has this conversation with her.
And my mind was on the ledge, saying, who's gonna have
it's cold up here. You leave the door open?
No, I did not leave the door open.
Somebody did. It wasn't me. Jesus Christ!
Hello, Gary.
Raylan.
You almost gave him a heart attack.
Sorry about that.
When I told him if you were going to shoot him, you'd have done it 6 years ago when I left you. What are you doing here, Raylan?
I'm working in Kentucky. Working for the marshal's office.
Oh, Raylan? What are you doing here?
I was in Nicaragua a while back looking for this money launderer named Roland Pike. The cartel's gun thug Tommy Bucks looking for him too. Bucks got me, took my gun, put me in a car with some other man. Drove us to a small coconut plantation. Then he tied the man to a palm tree and asked me where Roland was. I told him what I knew. No sense in lying. But I guess he wasn't certain he could believe me, needed to be sure, or he just wanted to impress upon me how serious he was. But I watched as Tommy Bucks stuck a stick of dynamite in that poor man's mouth. Taped it so I couldn't spit it out. Lit the fuse. Next time I saw Tommy Bucks in Miami, I told him he's got 24 hours to get out of town or I'm gonna kill him.
And you?
Yeah. But he pulled first, so I was justified. But what troubles me is what if he had Or if he just sat there, let the clock run out. I killed him anyway. No one wanted to. Guess I just never thought of myself as an angry man.
Raylan. You do a good job of hiding it, and I suppose most folks don't see it, but honestly, you're the angriest man I have ever known.
Okay, so she says, honestly, Raylan, you're the angriest person I've ever known. So obviously there's still some chemistry between the two, even though that was her new husband that got totally freaked out by Raylan sitting in a dark kitchen. But the picture that's given in this pilot episode is the picture that continues throughout all of Justified, this idea of a conflicted hero. And what I want to talk about in both these shows is that for both heroes, there's kind of a normalizing of the bad guy, the cowboy, and there is a sort of humanizing of the good guy, that the sheriff becomes someone who we can relate to because suddenly he is not this embodiment of objective law, someone who can stand for everything that he says he does stand for. And so for Raylan, in Miami, it's easier to be this face of objective law, but the season starts with him in Kentucky, like having to return to this place, having to return to the old wounds that have brought him to where he is. So he has this sort of sharpshooter reputation, but coming home to Kentucky, there's Harlan, where he comes from. There's Boyd Crowder, who is his best friend, but also the arch nemesis of the police force. His father is an old gun thug, and then there's this divorce that won't seem to go away, and this love that he said no to but still wants back. And so there is kind of this Faulknerian notion of the past isn't dead, it's still here, it's very much alive with where I stand now. And that's also why Raylan both loves and hates Kentucky. Because in some senses, it is him. It's very much him. And he feels understood there. That's why he can sit on the front porch with the villains. But at the same time, he hates Harlan because it is who he does not want to accept, the fact that that's actually who he is. So, anyways, I want to kind of position him as someone who wears a badge and a hat and uses those as identifiers that really act as a shield against which he doesn't want to face the reality of himself. And we see this in the next clip. This is Wynonna Hawkins. Again, this is from season two. They're actually back together, surprise, surprise. And she's a court reporter in the courthouse, and he works in the courthouse for the Marshal Service. And she has done a bad thing. She stole $100 from the vault, didn't think that it was going to be noticed, and actually it was part of an investigation, and so the FBI gets involved, and so she has to return this $100 bill and is totally conflicted about how to do it. And so she comes to Raylan, the law, you know, wearing the badge and the hat, and he must decide what to do. It's also, it becomes more complicated. So if we can go ahead and play that next clip. Also, the plot thickens. We kind of find out that she's done more than she said she had done.
It wouldn't match the one that he scanned.
Do you think they're going to look at it?
Well, it's a $100 bill that's part of a huge sum of money they haven't seen in 20 years. So, yeah, I do. I think they'll come look at it. Hey. It's not that big a deal. No, it ain't. It's one bill. Maybe you get a fine. It's not like you can do time for something like that.
No.
It's going to be okay.
Oh, it's not going to be okay.
You took all the money.
I don't know why. I mean, I could say it was because of Gary and all that bullshit I was going to use to get clear of him, or that I was going to use it for me and you, but honestly, the thought that kept going through my head over and over was just take it and worry about why later. So I go to take the money and put it in my purse, and then I realize my purse is too small, so, oh, gym bag. So I start stuffing it in my gym bag, and I drop the keys on Weaver's desk, and I get my car on my way here because I thought I would put it under the bed because I think this is a really safe place for it. So I'm in the car, and I think, hold on, what if it's counterfeit? What if that's why everybody's forgotten about it? So I think, okay, I'm going to take one bill to the bank, and they're going to let me know whether or not it's real. So I'm in the bank, and I'm waiting in line, and the teller yells, next. And I'm all, next for what? And then I'm like, oh, my God, what am I doing? I go to the front door because I'm going to take this back and I'm going to put it right where I found it. And this is going to be a really funny story that I tell you maybe someday. And the next thing I know is some guy's got a gun in my face and he's telling everybody to get on the floor. Say something.
Wow.
Say something else.
Why didn't you tell me about this yesterday?
Because I didn't want you to think I was someone who was capable of doing something like this.
Everyone's capable of doing something like this. Well, I come across huge sums of money, usually belong to bad people. I think no one will miss it.
Did you ever take it?
No.
I did. God, Jesus, what am I going to do?
Well, first thing we're going to do is put it back in the vault. And
hope No, Raylan, I'm not going to get you further involved in this.
You want to do this on your own?
Yeah.
How are you going to get past security?
I'll just put it in with some court documents. It's going to look like paper on the
inside. That Fire Rock case you're on, they have double security. They're hand-checking every bag. We'll take it through the marshal's entrance.
Oh, they don't have cameras back there?
They do.
So, if this whole thing goes to hell, people are going to know you're involved.
That's right. So let's make sure I don't go to hell.
Okay. So it's all going to go to hell if it gets found out because he is the representation of the law. And yet, if he... I guess the point that I want to make, it might be pretty obvious from this clip, but that... here is the law and someone who embodies the law, but he can't follow the law because he loves someone. And so you could argue or justify the fact that he is doing this because he loves this person. But at the same time, he is still subordinating the law for self-interest or for some personal interest of his own. So I guess this isn't just showing that Raylan Givens, like, isn't this perfected kind of Chuck Norris figure that can do no wrong. It's not just showing that he's imperfect. It's also showing that people are this way, that we can say that we are following the right rules and doing everything that we should be doing, but it covers the truth that we often do not and cannot, which leads me to Breaking Bad and how these shows come together. Because really what we see is that rather than justified, it's really just shorthand for self-justified. And that there is no such thing as sort of pure justice in human terms that is not also in some way self-justice. That always our self-interest kind of subordinates doing the right thing. And so for Raylan, that means kind of being the sheriff, wanting to hide behind the shield that can now define him, but still not being able to not be a Givens from Harlan, who has, like, a druggy father and an evil best friend. And for Walter White, it is this notion of ambition that blinds him, this myth of self-definition, which is the same thing that Raylan is under too. I can define myself. I can be who I say I am. And for Walter White, that self-definition begins to look like freedom, especially in the pilot. But it also becomes an object of projection, which completely blinds him. And so in regard to that secret ingredient, ambition, it's not just these television shows, but it's almost as if, you know, TV now makes these anti-heroes to point the finger back at us. And not just Americans, but people that we, by ambition, are blinded, and it blocks out love. And you see that with Facebook profiles. You see that with athletes, you know, that ambition for a certain kind of contract totally throws out the window any sort of team loyalty. Or relationships, marriages, you know, the desire to move to this city to do this job trumps the actual relationship itself. So this is from the pilot of Breaking Bad. If you are not familiar, Walter White has just found out in the pilot episode that he has terminal cancer. He has, at best, 2 years to live. He hasn't told his wife yet. And then so he decides, his brother-in-law is a DEA agent, and he sees him break up sort of a meth cook. And he starts to think, well, I could do that. I'm a chemist. He's sort of a famed chemist that fell from grace. He was a part of this company called Gray Matter that's now worth billions of dollars, and he left early. He took like a $5,000 pay leave and then became a high school chemistry teacher, and now it's like, you know, topping the NASDAQ or whatever. So there's kind of this sleeping shoulda, woulda, coulda in his head about what could have been. And then there's his wife, Skylar, who you'll see in this in the second part of this clip, and the son, Junior, who has cerebral palsy. But really what I want you to pay attention to is just kind of this new freedom that somehow the cancer seems to have invoked in him. So I'll go ahead and play that now.
This isn't even $7,000, all right? My dad wants 85.
This is all the money I have in the world. You're a drug dealer. Negotiate.
You are not how I remember you from class. I mean, like, not at all.
I gotta go.
Wait, hold on. Tell me why you're doing this. Seriously.
Why do you do it?
Money? Mainly?
There you go.
Nah, come on. Man, some straight like you, giant stick up his ass, all of a sudden at age, what, 60, he's just gonna break bad?
I'm 50.
It's weird, is all, okay? It doesn't compute. Listen, if you've gone crazy or something, I mean, if you've gone crazy or depressed, I'm just saying. That's something I need to know about, okay? I mean, that affects me.
I am awake.
What?
Buy the RV.
We start tomorrow.
How's it coming in there?
Fine.
Do you want me or your dad?
Dad.
So how are those feeling in the waist? Are they too tight? Because you don't want to get them if they're too tight.
They're pretty short.
Are you sure you don't want to get the, like, a different kind? Like, you know, the skinny jeans? Because those are really supposed to be in style now. The skaters wear them.
Do I look like a skater?
All right.
Mom, look at my big boy pants. Mama, could you zip up my big boy pants?
Don't.
What?
Don't.
Walt. I have no idea. No, you know what? Don't even look at them. They're obviously very stupid. Yeah. I think that, I think those jeans look really good on you. I think you should get them if you like them, okay? You know what? Why don't you just hang out here for a second? I'll be right back.
Oh, no. Hey, Mommy, I think I pinched a loaf in my brand new big boy pants.
What are you doing?
What's wrong, Chief? Having a little trouble walking?
Get off me!
Get off me!
I'll mess you up, man.
Well, you'll have one shot. You better make it good. What are you waiting for, your girlfriend? You better go. You better go. Take it. Take your shot. Take it! Come on. Come on.
Come on, let's get out of here. Go.
Psycho.
Okay. So you can see that, like, Mom and Junior are just, like, totally aghast at, like, this Walt they've never seen before. And it comes right after, you know, this diagnosis that is utterly defining. In 2 years or less, he will be dead. And it's a terminal statement, you know. And yet somehow there is this freedom, this sort of unhingedness that comes from that diagnosis. I am awake, is what he says. And so that it seems like there is some justice there, you know, like you totally get pumped when he walks into the store and, you know, beats up the bully. But I want to make an argument that this kind of freedom comes from a defining diagnosis, but that it is a perverted freedom for Walter White because he wants to define himself. He still wants, like, this is not an opportunity to cry for help and surrender, but it is a moment, a last gasp attempt to define himself, to become the person that he always wanted to be and never was. So he is about to become the cowboy, the new cowboy of Albuquerque, New Mexico, making meth, and he will be known as Heisenberg, and he will have his own hat to sort of identify himself as the projection of what he wishes he was. And so there's this, that Kris Kristofferson song, Freedom's Just Another Word for Nothing Left to Lose, and it seems like the makers of Breaking Bad here are saying that when there's nothing left to lose, we are still like chomping at the bit to define ourselves. That even at rock bottom, we still choose power or ambition or some means of self-definition before we can actually accept the fact that we're dying or we're dead. And so left to our own devices, Vince Gilligan, the creator, seems to be saying that we still cling to our images of ourself. I'm going to kind of trumpet the devotional a couple times in my talk because it's been my life for the last 6 months working for Mockingbird. So this is actually from Simeon, who talked first this morning. It's one of his devotions from Nehemiah. And he kind of talks about this idea of the mind's desire to create realities for itself. The mind is a master illusionist. It's possible to spend our whole lives shadow boxing with unrealities we have invented out of our own mind. Nothing seems more real than the rejection we perceive in an oddly raised eyebrow, an inopportune yawn, the scowl of a stranger, The mind can spin an epic tale of misunderstanding and betrayal out of the smallest and most meaningless experience. In that sense, it is immensely creative, but it is a dull sort of creativity because it is so often manufacturing the same boring stories of our fears, our aspirations, and our anxieties. There is no reality here. So, unless it comes externally from the grace of God, and this is not a show that highlights the grace of God in any way whatsoever, internally, if we're doing it ourselves, all we can do to sort of get out of the impasse is to create an unreality that will help us deal with it. So, that being said, what's also addictive and intriguing about this show is that there's a part of us that really likes to see that. I mean, we really like to see the guy getting what he wants. I mean, it's part of the American dream. We see this guy who's been down and out his whole life. He finds out he's got cancer, and so we're rooting for him to cook meth to provide for his family. And we kind of get pumped when we see this beatdown because it's justice, right? And yet, this show, and one of the main themes, is like one of the greatest wraths we can receive is accomplishment or achievement of what we want, which we see in Walter White. He gets everything that he wants, and yet it all turns sour in his hands. And this is kind of a theme with a lot of TV shows right now. I mean, the modern American anti-hero. You've got Walter White, but you also have Don Draper. And you also have Frances Underwood. I don't know if any of you guys have watched House of Cards that's on Netflix, but there's a lot of these characters who have become villains because they achieve. They achieve exactly what they've been working for, and you see them suffer it. I don't have to say this, but you can think of times in your life, too, when the greatest wrath you've received was getting something that you knew you wanted. So, this is what's happened for Walt in season 5. If you haven't seen season 5, that's fine. I'm not going to give too many of the plot details away. What I will say is that he was working for the meth lord in the American Southwest, Gustavo Fring. He has killed Gustavo Fring, and he has begun what he calls the empire business. He's no longer in the money business or the meth business. He's in the empire business. And this Jesse is still in the picture, the one that you saw in the car. He's kind of the prodigal son in a lot of ways, and you really... you start out thinking he's kind of a dope, and then by the end, I think now we're all rooting for him. We want him to kind of find his way out of Walt's projections. And then the other character you'll see is Mike, who is kind of this hard-nosed, he was once a cop, and now he's a criminal, but he does everything very, very rigidly. He understands that there are things you must do to protect yours, and to also escape being caught. So this is after their first big cook. They have begun sort of the big operation. Jesse is in the middle between this argument, and they're kind of collecting their money for the first big cook. I think Gilligan wants us to as well to put ourselves in Jesse's position between Walter White, this guy who is whose ambition is sort of limitless, and Mike, who understands that there must be a price to be paid for what they've done. This is called hazard pay.
Okay, for you and you and me, $367,000 each.
Ooh, wait a minute. After the dealers got their cut, we should be looking at $1,379,560. Mike, you're short. You're almost 300,000 short.
You're forgetting about the mules. They get a flat 20%.
The what?
The drivers, they're the ones that take the product from us to the dealers.
And so, transportation is worth 20%?
They're taking a risk.
$275,000 worth of risk? Wow. What did Gus pay his mules?
Gustavo Fring didn't use mules. He didn't need them. He spent 20 years building his own distribution. He had 16 refrigerator trucks running his product. And do you know where they are now? Government impound. You don't like paying 20%. Maybe you shouldn't have killed the guy.
Hey. There's still over $1 million here, all right? That's for one cook.
Since you're putting on the green eye shade, my supplier and I came to an agreement. The methylamine is free this time. But brace yourself, because the next barrel is going to cost big. Can we continue, or you got any more burning questions?
Okay, kid. You fronted us 120 to get us going. So that's 40 from him and me. 120.
Yes. Thank you, Jesse.
Okay. Now, Ira gets 110 for our piece of the business and 25 per cook. That is 45 from each of us. Ira's guys get 10 each per cook. Goodman's cut, 18,000 from each. Legacy cost, $351,000, that's $117,000 each.
Legacy cost? I got 9 guys. You don't know them, but they were part of the previous operation, and they know a lot. And right now, some of them are in jail, and more will be soon. The feds RICO'd their hazard pay. So, we are going to make them whole.
We are going to make them whole. What is this we? These were Gus's employees, not ours.
They might have been Gus's employees, but they're my guys.
So, what are they doing to further our interests?
The cops are looking at them very closely. We don't want them furthering our interest.
So we are paying them. Why?
Because it's what you do.
Oh. It's what you do.
My guys are keeping their mouths shut. We make them whole. One hand washes the other. It's as simple as that.
Huh. It sounds like a simple shakedown, simple as that. We're paying for their silence. That's blackmail.
Business is my end. This is business. End of story.
This is your problem. It should come out of your end.
Hey. Stick out of mine. All right? Go for it. I don't care. Just take it.
No. Jesse, thank you, but... No. I'll pay my share. Go ahead.
Let me tell you something. This is how it's going to be from here on out. My guys are an ongoing expenditure. So you best get yourself comfortable with it.
$137,000. Less than with Fring.
Listen, Walter, just because you shot Jesse James, don't make you Jesse James.
It's such a cool line. So, in some ways, Mike is the foil for Walter. There is like this acceptance of the fact that, like, we are breaking the law, and with the law comes a cost. There's a hazard pay that must be paid to sort of keep us safe. And so he, because he's not blinded by ambition, the law, who the law says he is clear to Mike. With Walter, he has become blind to it. But more than that, what I want to talk about is just this stack of money, you know, this divided stack of money, and watching it sort of slip away, slip away, slip away. He's now in the empire business, and he is the emperor, he's the king, and yet the amount of maintenance that is required totally takes it all away. He's getting paid less now than when he was the number two man cooking meth for a boss. And so again, I feel like Breaking Bad is saying that there is like this chunk of glory that you must sort of siphon off as you pay the price for your ambition. And hazard pay for Mike isn't just about like keeping guys from squawking or turning them in or getting them caught, but that there is some kind of cosmic price that must be paid for your actions. So anyways, besides that, this notion of maintenance, of first having achieved what you wanted to achieve and then having to maintain that achievement, is the tiresome burden that sort of carries through the entire show. If you've watched the show, there's so many comments that are about like tying up loose ends, or we need to clean that up, or we need to make this disappear, or this can't have happened. And it is unending. It is the basis of the show. The show runs on tying up loose ends, hiding from the cops and tying off loose ends. And then also, if you've watched the show, there is this obsession with cleanliness. You'll see that like there's scenes where like it'll be focusing on a fly that's like flying around the room, and Walter just is obsessed with getting that fly. Or there's a stain, like when he receives his diagnosis for his cancer. He can't help, he can't listen to what the doctor is saying because he can't stop focusing on like a mustard stain that is on the doctor's jacket. There's this obsession with cleanliness and disinfecting, because if anything is going to happen, it's going to happen because something infected or something, life sort of came in and made this thing die. So Vince Gilligan always does, though, is show that these contaminants are everywhere. When they're cooking, you know, you'll see a fly flying around, or in the fifth season they start cooking in these like houses that are being dusted for termites, and there's little termites like crawling around where they're cooking meth, and so it's almost like the contaminants are waiting, but at some point it's nature's going to bring justice of its own. So, again, from the devotional, this is from David Browder, and he kind of talks about this idea as the myth of self-created identity. And here's what he says. Another thing that dies when life happens is the idea of self-created identity. This is baldly prevalent in the United States, but it's the same in Africa or anywhere else. It's Aristotle's idea that you are the sum of your actions. If this is true, and if it is, there's no Christ, then life is vexation and striving after wind, because you have to recreate yourself every day for your entire life. Even if you were to theoretically succeed, the end of your life comes and you're quickly forgotten. Your gains are distributed among others, and the whole process begins again. Which is so dark, I know, but this show is dark, and it's true, you know, that there are these strivings and achievements and the maintenance of them, and then what does it all mean? Because, like, nature has its way with us in the end anyways, right? This maintenance is exhausting for Walt, and his ambition has actually clouded the idea of needing it. He doesn't want to pay off these mules or pay off the guys in prison who may squawk, because, like, that's my money, and this is keeping me from growing into what I think I should be. And I love that Mike says, like, this is the way it's going to be from now on. So, anyways, another element is that this isn't, it doesn't just happen at work. It also happens at home. The first thing that Skyler says to Walt in the pilot episode is, Walter, what's been going on with you this week? I feel like you've been shutting me out, and shutting me out is the worst thing you can do. And the entire show is this shutting out. His home becomes a barricade. And in season 5, it gets even creepier. Yeah, I was going to show that clip, but I want to save that for another time. Basically, what has happened is it's totally gone from love to restraint. Like, it's his 51st birthday, a year after his cancer diagnosis, and in the first season, the 50th birthday was this huge celebration, and people were around, and you could tell that this was a house of love, despite the fact that no one knew about his cancer or that he was thinking about cooking meth. You could see that the house was a loving house. Here, on his 51st birthday, Skyler has, like, faked this nervous breakdown, though I don't really know it's a nervous breakdown. Faked, it could just have been real, but she basically, like, walks into their backyard pool and in the attempt to get the kids out of the house. Like, she loves her kids so much, but she doesn't want her kids to be sort of stuck in the house with Heisenberg. And Skyler understands that she's compromised because she's been laundering his money, but she doesn't want her kids to be compromised as well. And so there's this weird scene where they're fighting back and forth, and you really feel like Skyler is imprisoned in her own bedroom. So I guess there's this in the final moment in that scene, she says to Walter, my only hope is just to sit back and wait. I have nothing else to do. Like, you are too powerful for me, but all I can do is wait. And he's like, wait for what? And she just looks at him like, you don't actually know what I'm about to say. I'll just wait for the cancer to come back. And that's how the episode ends. I mean, it's completely bloodless. I mean, it's so creepy, but that's what's happened in a year. He's hit his impasse, and ambition has taken him to everything that he thought he wanted, but it has completely turned dead in his hands. But her only hope is waiting. And in a show that's all about loose ends and tying up loose ends, I think what Breaking Bad is moving towards is this idea that there is this elemental loose end that we all have that is waiting for us, and it's death. And that's her only hope, is that nature would take its course. She can't intervene, she can't do anything, but she can wait. So the creators of Breaking Bad are just really good at showing that we are our own loose end, that we sort of create the ends that we don't even really need, like a meth business, but we actually sort of we create just on our own an ambition or a vision for ourselves that is enough to sort of be our road to hell. So he was on, Vince Gilligan was on Stephen Colbert, I guess a couple years ago, and the way he described his show is he said, the old phrase, like, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, which I'd never really heard before, struck him, and that's kind of the reason that he made this show, to show how someone with, you know, arguably good reasons for doing what he's doing could still just be completely taken down his own road to hell. So, where is the hope? And I feel like the hope in this show is with Jesse Pinkman, the sort of lovable prodigal that was Walt's student in high school. And because he's compromised, because he's involved in the business, the only way that any real salvation can happen is if he's actually caught. And you find Jesse actually craving some kind of judgment upon himself. He doesn't want to just get away, but he wants to understand the cost of what they have done, the people that they've killed. And so this last scene that I want to show is Jesse has been going to a 12-step program. And it's weird because on one hand, he goes because he's trying to sell meth to the addicts that are in the 12-step program. And then on the other hand, he is going because he actually is hearing what they're saying and it's actually doing some good for him. And so he keeps going sort of nominally because he's doing his job, but at the same time, he's hearing the message. And yet, in this scene, he has just killed someone. And it is tearing him up inside. And he feels a moral conscience about it, but he cannot tell anyone about it, obviously. And so he makes up this story about killing a dog when he's sitting in this 12-step program. And it's just interesting to see what he does. Go ahead and play that.
We got to own our actions, but putting ourselves on trial, acting as our own judge, jury, and executioner, it's not the answer. Because a lot of the time, all that judging does is just ensure that we're going to repeat the cycle. Right? I'm such an asshole. It's totally hopeless. What's the point? I think I'll have a hit. Jesse, what's going on with you these days?
I went back to the crystal.
You sober now?
Yeah. 4 days. Big whoop, right?
Hey, 4 days is 4 days. You're here. You still working at the laundry? How are things there?
Sucks ass.
Anything you want to talk about?
A couple weeks back, I killed a dog.
You hit it with your car?
No, I put him down. I watched him go. I was looking him straight in the eye. And he didn't know what was happening. He didn't know why. He was just scared. And then he was gone.
He was suffering. It was the kindness.
No, he wasn't sick. He was just like a... I don't know, like a problem dog.
What'd he do? Bite someone?
This dog never bit anybody.
You pick up the rock, you go right to the dark side. Anything can happen.
Hey, no rock that made me do it.
Well, what was the problem? Why'd you have to kill him?
Watch the crosstalk, please. Maybe it's not the details that matter, right? How'd you feel about what you did, Jesse? I don't know.
Who cares how you feel? What kind of a person kills a dog for no reason?
Colleen.
You put an ad in the paper, you drop him off at
Colleen.
A shelter, you just sit there and talk about killing a helpless, innocent
Colleen.
Animal.
We're not here to sit in judgment.
Why not? Why not? Maybe she's right. You know, maybe I should have put it in the paper. Maybe I should have done something different. The thing is, if you just do stuff and nothing happens, what's it all mean? What's the point? Oh, right, this whole thing is about self-acceptance.
Kicking the hell out of yourself doesn't give meaning to anything.
So I should stop judging and accept.
To start.
So no matter what I do, hooray for me because I'm a great guy. It's all good. No matter how many dogs I kill, I just want to do an inventory and accept. I mean, you back your truck over your own kid and you, like, accept? What a load of crap.
Hey, Jesse, I know you're in pain.
No, you know what? Why I'm here in the first place is to sell you meth. You're nothing to me but customers. I made you my bitch.
You okay with that? Huh? You accept?
No. About time.
Yeah. So there's a lot to say about that, but one is that everyone that was sort of trying to make him feel better about the dead dog, which wasn't a dead dog, but the death of an innocent person, was platitudes. And he was trying to receive the deserved judgment that he needed. He needed there to be justice, because if there's no justice, then acceptance means nothing. You know, acceptance is BS if it's not in the face of knowing someone fully, knowing the reality of someone. And so everyone has these, like, platitudes and casts them out like Job's comforters, and they don't hit because they're not true of Jesse's situation. It wasn't a dog. He wasn't on drugs when he did it. It wasn't something that was necessarily needed. He did it. And so this idea of self-acceptance being a start, he's saying it is not a start. You can't start with self-acceptance. Because if acceptance is coming from me, I already know that I'm rotten. And I need justice to be placed upon me before acceptance makes any sense whatsoever. And acceptance still doesn't make sense. So without judgment and sorrow, and to steal from Luther, utterly despairing of ourselves, there's no hope. There's no hope unless that's the starting point. So the last thing I want to say is, if this is sort of the modern anti-hero, who is the hero? And, you know, there's the sort of myth of self-creation, of self-definition, and if Christ is the hero, then there is the reality of self-abnegation, of self-release, of being sort of a no-self for the sake of others, and rather than the maintenance of loose ends and keeping things sort of tied up and clean, there are no loose ends to tie up with Christ because it's all known honestly. And in regards to this creation of a world that is totally a projection of the self, which we're all guilty of projecting realities upon each other and upon the world around us, our environments and circumstances, instead of that, there is the all-absorbing, rather than the self who projects everything that he sees within, without. There is Jesus, who is the all-absorbing no-self, who takes upon the sins of the world, who wears no hat and has divested himself for the sake of you and me. So, with that in mind, we're selling this on the book table. I'm going to close with this, but Christian Wyman's My Bright Abyss, it just came out. He kind of talks about this this Christian no-self in a way that I haven't even, I've really never heard it. So beautiful. Okay. Christianity itself is this, temporal, relative to some extent. To every age, Christ dies anew and is resurrected within the imagination of man. This is why he could be a paragon of rationality for 18th century England, a heroic figure of the imagination for the Romantics, an exemplar of existential courage for writers like Paul Tillich and Bultmann. One truth, then, is that Christ is always being remade into the image of man, which means that his reality is always being deformed to fit human needs, or what humans perceive to be their needs. A deeper truth, though, one that Scripture suggests when it speaks of the eternal Word being made specific flesh, is that there is no permutation of humanity in which Christ is not present. If every Bible is lost, if every church crumbles to dust, if the last believer in the last prayer opens her eyes and lets it all finally go, Christ will appear on this earth as calmly and casually as he appeared to the disciples walking to Emmaus after his death, who did not recognize this man to whom they had pledged their very lives, this man whom they had seen beaten, crucified, abandoned by God, this man who, after walking the dusty road with them, after sharing an ordinary meal and discussing the Scriptures, had to vanish once more in order to make them see. Thank you. If we have a little bit of time, if anybody wants to share their thoughts on anything I've said, but also about the shows, or I'd love to hear them. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Whether Heisenberg is Walter White, or if... Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I think that's right. I think that is sort of like when we get everything that we want, it almost is like a caricature of our true selves. I mean, they're... subliminally sort of quieted when we're walking through our day-to-day. But if we had sort of unlimited access to everything we wanted, I would be Heisenberg, or I would be some permutation of Heisenberg. And thank God I don't always get what I want, you know? So, yeah. That's really interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that we could recognize him.
Wow.
So even the story that you just said with Emmaus.
Yeah, yeah.
Then after he disappeared, then they remembered.
Yeah.
The word.
Hmm. Yeah.
The story, the scripture. So I'm struggling because of the, you know, I've never seen Greg like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're waiting for a word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I don't know the answer to it. But
I love this. This is fabulous.
Yeah, I mean I guess what he's getting at is the idea of in the incarnation, the crucifixion, and the resurrection, all that was like the good news of the gospel that we believe is Jesus dying for sins on earth, and that being done for all time in all places in all circumstances for all people, and so that I think that that's the reality that he's pointing to, is the universality of Christ dying for every permutation of the human race. The question about faith is an interesting one that I don't really know the answer to, of whether or not the scriptures being burned away and all the last prayers being said. I guess he's pointing to the fact that the reality of Christ wins through regardless, that it is objective truth. But yeah. Anybody have any? Yeah, Brennan.
I'm sure I'm a big fan of Breaking Bad, and I have read a lot of other critiques on it. Do you think that, it seems like Vince is another one of the themes is this whole notion of like this scathing critique on the ends justifying the means,
mm-hmm.
and how that kind of it starts slowly where he starts dealing drugs, then he kills criminals, then he's actually like poisoning innocent little boys and mm-hmm. things like that. And it gets very, it seems very kind of, it's interesting in our culture now. I heard recently that corporate culture and a culture of relativism has a really tough time defining values, and like why, if profit is the end goal, like why should we just not lay off as many people as possible or do things that might be morally questionable because we don't really have any morals to stand on.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think? Have you heard Vince talk much about this whole notion of like the ends justifying the means and how because it seems very prevalent throughout
the show. From the interviews I've heard and some of the writing I've seen, it seems like he wants to accentuate the fact, yes, that this is like an American story, and he does use a lot of like cowboy tropes to kind of to show that this is sort of like the modern American cowboy. Yes, he's neurotic because we are, but there's still train heists and stick-ups and all the all the secrets of cowboy lore. And so he is pointing to like an American problem, but at the same time, more of what he tends to focus on is sort of the biblical human element. But that idea of like sort of the ends justifying the means he's trying to get down to sort of the individual atomic structure of it, rather than the it being merely like a critique of American culture. But yeah, it is. I mean, it's everywhere in the show. Yeah. Is the mic?
I feel like if you look at Breaking Bad from the other characters' points of view, like if you from every character's point of view but Walter's, I think it feels to me like the cancer doesn't come back because he's literally becomes a cancer on them. Like he is literally a cancer on society. He encounters people who seem to stand for powerful institutions. Gus kind of stands for business, and Hank kind of stands for, law enforcement, the state. And starting when he really sort of, like, maybe the end of the second season when, you have the plane crash and he basically kills Jesse's girlfriend, he destroys Jesse's life by virtue of Jesse being unable to resist him. And, these try as they might, I mean, these people like private, Gus, the business community, the state, law enforcement, they just can't get rid of him. And he ends up killing them, And so it's sort of like, I mean, I think you actually, I was wondering, if you look at it, like that, about what is it about, you know, what is it saying about institutions that somehow they can't resist this evil, you know, that this, like, this destructive force is like, he says he's in the empire business, so there's literally no point to what he's doing besides just lashing out and ruining everything for everyone and eventually just being, if he succeeds, completely alone in the world, like a cancer on society. Yeah. So yeah. What is it about, like, institutions like Gus's company, you know, what is it about Hank as a detective? Why can't the law enforcement community perceive this right in front of them? You know, so I think, I mean, if you're gonna, I do kind of look at it like it's sort of about, you know, about American culture at large, and it's kind of, it's about those institutions and why, whatever it is that Walter is, they can't resist it, you know. And I don't know. What do you think about that?
And it's interesting too, how, like, and you see it in that hazard pay scene where. Mike is talking about Gus being sort of this Jesse James, and everything is so, like, done so deliberately and clean. And there's another scene where Mike talks about Fring's business and says, like, we had a good thing going. Like, no one was going to find out about this. This was clean, you know. And Mike sort of embodies that too. And in a way, it's like they found a way to kind of check their ambition. And they were still an enormous corporation, but they knew sort of how to live within means. And yet, you get the sense that Walt's in no way an emperor like Gustavo was. It's like he's still kind of an idiot in regards to the fact that he can't control, like, his yearning for the gray matter CEO that he always wanted to be. So. But yeah, I totally agree with the it being a commentary on American life, American modern life. It's also true in Mad Men and House of Cards, just in different sort of environs. But, like, you see this, and how interesting that, like, today in television we're watching these shows that. That we love watching these kind of anti-heroes, you know, and what the motivation is behind the creator and pointing the finger back at the viewer, you know. I'm really pumped to see kind of how it all ends. Like, it could go in so many different directions, and I'd love to talk to you guys about how you are predicting it. We should get some lunch. I'm starving. Thank you.